ex-con to an intellectual visionary with a race and class analysis. He went from being a narrow nationalist to incorporating a broad global perspective. He articulated a strong challenge to the system of power and privilege. Consequently, the FBI wiretapped Malcolm, read his mail, and kept him under surveillance. A riveting orator, he gave talks throughout the country, including his famous ballot or the bullet speech. On February 21, 1965, Malcolm X was gunned down at the Audubon Ballroom in West Harlem. To talk about Malcolm's life and work and his continuing relevance for today is Michael Eric Dyson. Michael Eric Dyson, a globally renowned scholar of race, religion, and contemporary culture, is the Centennial Chair and University Distinguished Professor of African American and Diaspora Studies at Vanderbilt University. He's the author of many books, including Entertaining Race and Represent, The Unfinished Fight for the Vote. This classic from the AR archives marks Malcolm X's centenary. It was recorded at the University of Colorado as part of Black History Month in 1995. And now, Michael Eric Dyson on Malcolm X.
Malcolm X remains a haunting figure in the collective imagination of many people of color, but he also haunts the American landscape in broad terms. He does so because he is the supreme embodiment of the ostensible politics of black rage. That is, Malcolm X is the point man in the furious onslaught of black rage directed at the premises and practices of white supremacy. A person who garnered such tremendous acclaim because of his rhetorical scorn heaped upon the heads of those he believed were the detrimental embodiment of ideas that harmed African American people and of a vicious history of racism that undermined African American life. But Malcolm X was much more than a point man in this vicious onslaught and this vigorous onslaught of black rage directed at white supremacy. Now, we should admit that he certainly knew how to manipulate the rhetoric of rage, and not simply at white Americans. Malcolm X was known to, as we all know, police the boundaries of black identity by claiming a privileged spot within the framework of both African American leadership, but more important, within the framework of identification with average, everyday, ordinary black Americans. Malcolm's appeal was not simply that he forced white people to deal with black people on their own terms, that is, on black Americans' own terms, not the kind of kowtowing and yes-siring and yes-ma'aming and manipulation of the rhetoric of Christian love, even though it masked a universe and a cosmos of passion to resist the function of white racism, that is, to slip through the premises of white superiority, the ingenious manner in which Martin Luther King Jr. and others in the civil rights movement appealed to the conscience of white Americans, and by appealing to the conscience of white Americans to enact a drama of resistance to racial domination. Malcolm X wanted to do it on the terms that were indigenous to the mindset of everyday people. And that is that he spoke in such powerful and lucid ways, with such eloquent oration and declamation, the deepest held most cherished principles of fierce pride that could scarcely be granted public perception or at least public airing. And yet Malcolm did that. He spoke truth to power in ways that made people uncomfortable, white and black. He was about not only calling a spade, but he was also about going further than merely calling a spade, but to describe the spadeness of the spade. And Malcolm was good for that. In very narrow and bigoted ways sometimes, he appealed to this rhetoric of rage to police these borders of authentic black identity by calling people like King Reverend Dr. Chicken Wing, Uncle Tom, and referring to other black leaders as people who were selling out the interests of the African American community. And so, contrary to the civil rights movement and the appeal to white conscience and the beneficence of white Americans to somehow find within their collective resources the ethical energy to remove themselves from the most heinous manifestations of racial domination, Malcolm X was of I don't give a damn school. And part of his continuing appeal to so many is the way in which he continues to be frozen in his own rhetorical rage. In Malcolm's own word, they won't let me turn the corner. And the corner he wanted to turn was toward a much broader appreciation of the factors and forces that made African Americans who and what they are, and that would enable them to move beyond narrow, insular, parochial, bigoted preoccupations to a more Catholic understanding of American society. The irony, of course, is that Malcolm was much more American than he was willing to give on to. A person who was obsessed with purity at a certain level can't help but be a certain kind of American. An American, of course, influenced by certain European discourses about purity. The irony, of course, as many intellectual historians tell us, is that even as black Americans look back to America in some kind of inferiority, America looks back to Europe in a similar sense of inferiority. And so the back-looking lends us a kind of genealogy where we understand the quest for purity is a particularly American-European construction that we somehow see manifested in Malcolm's own rhetoric. And so his policing of these boundaries and borders of African American identity gave way near the end of his life to a much broader embrace of people across the chasm of race. And had we lived, we can only hope of class and sexual preference and gender. But the Malcolm that was more about the broad humanity was the Malcolm who was obscured, marginalized within the history of black American politics because his use within popular culture is of a figure who gives authority to young, especially African American men and women, caught in niches of political powerlessness within the urban post-industrial city. Post-industrial cities which capture the lives of so many young people of color. Malcolm's lifestyle resonates with the choices and chances that young people of color have in many of these post-industrial urban slots. The decreased ability to get a, shall we say, high-waged, low-skilled job. The decreased ability to operate within an American economy that is increasingly captive to technological forces and the so-called super information highway that has few exits in the black community. The so-called ability to participate in American democracy that is increasingly available to average ordinary Americans and especially people of color. And so Malcolm's rhetoric appeals, understandably, to young people looking for bold, defiant gestures. Rhetoric that will speak the kind of hidden masked rage at some points and the quite explicit rage that they feel toward a system that fundamentally refuses to accept, understand, or concede their humanity. And the debate about humanity connected to people of color, African peoples in America, is, as many intellectual historians have reminded us, a relatively new invention in modern Western society. The notion that people of color could engage in abstract rationality, could somehow make connections between concepts that were not immediately or available or concrete, is a relatively new development in the evolution of thinking about people of color. And Malcolm connected viscerally to that realization. In other words, he understood quite clearly that what was at stake was not rhetoric, but reality. What was at stake was the very conception of people and human beings. And so what he did was make it so clear that it was virtually unbearable, not simply by white Americans who were taken aback. This was not "We Shall Overcome." This was not "Sing Along with the Bouncing Beat of Harmony and Brotherhood." This was rather in-your-face refusal to concede any ground to the morality of American public discourse about race. It was an unwillingness to even acknowledge that there was a fundamental logic that undergird American public discourse about race, and if it was a logic, it was a viciously circular one. And Malcolm pressed that claim in public in ways now that young black people looking for very explicit articulations of rage and anger, and also very particular defiances expressed toward the dominant powers that be. The problem, of course, is the changed racial landscape we have inherited as Americans. As the increase of black middle class, as the upward social mobility has differentiated the classes in African-American society so that under segregation, when school teachers in the middle class were forced to live with people who were so-called working class and even the permanently poor, the so-called ghetto poor, there was a kind of common experience forged as a result of the rigid rule of segregation in northern industrial cities as well as the rural South. So that you could be in Harlem and, you know, you could be a poor boy, but at least you could see Paul Robeson coming down the street. "No more auction block for me." "How you doing, Mr. Robeson?" "Go up the street and Langston Hughes might be writing, 'I've known rivers, deep, deep rivers,' right? You go up the street and so on, this mythical, you know, it is romantic and utopic at a certain level. Not to suggest that class divisions weren't riven throughout those African-American communities tightly contained, rigidly turfed by segregation and the forces of an American culture that refused to allow the expansion of black life beyond certain geographical limitations. But the geography of imagination expanded, as well as the opportunities of people of color to move beyond these rigidly segregated enclaves. And so what happens with this upward social mobility is the class differentiation within African-American culture. And so the difficulty of merely appealing to rage that is more than radical chic, rage that refuses to address its own class contradictions, race language that refuses to acknowledge that all black folk are not the same, so that the disproportionate influence of certain segments of African-American middle class within the context of black politics and the larger context of African-American society means that we've got to back up and then use Malcolm's most broadly humanitarian legacy to try to force a rethinking of the politics of race in American society. And I want to suggest a few ways in which that can occur. First of all, the rethinking of class differentiation within African-American culture was a force that Malcolm intuited in his latter-day career and grabbed onto in a vigorous way as he improvised in the last 50 weeks of his life. Here was a person then who understood that the battle was much more international than we had been led to believe. That as he visits the Congo, as he goes through the Gold Coast, as he goes throughout Africa and Mecca, as he goes throughout the world, he begins to understand that socialist politics may be a way of gaining more participation of people over in the governments that regulate their lives and more control over the institutions which govern their lives. Which meant that Malcolm began to understand the necessity for a fierce engagement with class politics and to address the enormous class inequalities and inequities
that were rife in American culture and that increasingly were characterized in African American life. This, by the way, is the same insight to which King was granted access in the latter part of his career. We remember King now for I Have a Dream, Pepsi-Cola commercials, McDonald's, talk about him, that great dreamer, that wonderful man, pictures, the snow-capped Rockies of Colorado, the heightening Alleghenies of Pennsylvania, Let Freedom Ring, from Lookout Mountain in Tennessee. And that's all good. But the reality is that the echo that came back to King from the snow-capped Rockies of Colorado was the reality of Watts fires on the ground. And so this forced him, this coerced him into a much more radical disposition in vis-a-vis American politics. It forced King to see the necessity for a revolution of values. Similarly then, with Malcolm X, he began to perceive the necessity for engaging in class warfare. And that class warfare had already been anticipated to certain degrees in his own Nation of Islam experiences, where he harped upon the narrownesses and bigotries and blindnesses of the petty bourgeois Negro leaders who were pimping, in his own words, and prostituting, in his own words, the average everyday African American. And so Malcolm began to see the necessity for what I will term, in a kind of, you know, backshadowing, as Gary Morrison calls it, radical democracy. That is, the need for people to have some say over the institutions which run their lives. And this Malcolm, then, is not the one who is easily appropriated by popular culture, even though I think the ingenuity of Spike Lee's presentation of Malcolm X is that it at least showed us an intellectual Malcolm X, a black man manipulating rhetoric in American culture in the cinematic expression for 4 and 5 minutes at a time. The focus was on his verbal rhetorical skills, his oratorical declamation, his ability to engage in forensic debate with the most fierce of enemies and yet to come out on top. This was an enormous achievement in an anti-intellectual environment, but also it implicitly put forth the proposition that people of color had ideas, even those who were on the so-called fanatic fringe. But even that film failed to grasp the profound complexities of Malcolm's latter-day international vision. Even that film failed to address the enormous transformations being wrought in Malcolm X near the end of his life, when he began to look beyond the pale of race and beyond the mere confinements of ethnic specificity, to look to see that class was a powerful force and that economic misery was spread throughout African-American communities. If racism is destroyed, African-American people are still poor. Now, Malcolm was not willing to give up on the particular formation of race in terms of personal identity or in terms of its impact upon most people who were poor. In other words, even when he came back from Mecca, he said, hold up, that was in Mecca. That was in Arabia. You know, that was my Arab brothers and sisters who wondered who could be white and light and steal my brothers and sisters. But up here in America, closer to home, he understood that the particularity of race, that he refused to dehistoricize race. He refused to be apolitical about the social meanings of race. He refused to give in to the belief that you could somehow subsume race under this larger category of class. So he had his kind of burgeoning socialist politics in place, but he refused to do what certain vulgar or orthodox Marxists appropriations of race have done, is to re-describe racial misery in terms of larger economic forces. Malcolm wanted to see both of them being given attention to and paid serious intellectual attention to. So on the one hand, he understood that race was still ruling in American society and that class inequalities were somehow linked to racial desperation. But economic misery for Malcolm X was somehow such an important quality of determining the legitimacy of social theory that he wanted to move beyond mere race. This Malcolm we know nothing about. This Malcolm we hear nothing about. This is not the Malcolm, of course, appropriated by hip-hop culture. And the contradictions, as we know, in hip-hop culture between appropriating Malcolm X and his politics of rage and a person like Minister Louis Farrakhan. Now, of course, the contradictions between Minister Farrakhan and Minister Malcolm X are now writ large upon the canvas of American recent human, recent American history. We see this expressed, of course, in the Kabila Shabazz debacle that has come tumbling forward from the lunatic mind of both the FBI and the conspiracy predilections, or at least the kind of conspiracy theory that is being propagated within the Nation of Islam. And the interesting thing is, of course, as I've tried to argue before, is that black folk are caught in the middle. People say, on the one hand, you know, of course the government can do stuff like this. People say, isn't it rather odd that the government would cook up these plans to try to get at Minister Louis Farrakhan by hatching up a scheme to say he was being hunted by Kabila Shabazz? Well, no, not really, given the history of the FBI, which often meant for brothers imprisonment. For us, I could see the FBI stood for brothers to be in prison, right? And to infiltrate the movement of African-American men and women to undermine that African-American leadership. Why should we be so amazed that the FBI could do this? On the other hand, pimping the language of conspiracy covered the contradictions of many African-American groups that refused to concede that black folk could disagree and still live together. And this is the problem, of course, by the appropriations in popular culture of the politics of Malcolm's rage and his rhetoric without digging deeper, without excavating, without going beneath the rhetoric, without getting a kind of subcutaneous, beneath the skin of the rhetoric. Excuse those nasty kind of metaphors. But to dig deeper and to get deeper into the ground of Malcolm's own profound reflections upon the necessity for solidarity beyond disagreement. And so the problem in this so-called age of appropriation of race and popular culture is that it doesn't address the class contradictions or the kind of internal group infighting that disallows disagreement. I cannot tell you how many times I've received letters from people. I've written about Leonard Jeffries and other so-called controversial figures and ideas, and they write me letters, call me out my name, don't call me the name my mama gave me. And then, you know, I get on radio program, they be said, this is the handkerchief head Negro. Uncle Tom, this is the kind of Negro white folk love. So they invite to their universities. Well, I guess that is true. But the point is, said he's just the kind of guy can be manipulated by them. And then, you know, of course, I get on the radio, and if I'm in a good mood, I try to, you know, be in my Christian self, and I look above it. If I'm in my Detroit Negro style, I'm throwing the dozens right with them. I'll be talking about their mamas and daddies, and, you know, and of course, in style, I don't do it explicitly. I try to mask it. But I try to signify on them, you know? But the tragedy is, and of course, and then I'm caught. Because then I get calls from hate monitors, and they call me up, Professor Dyson, we heard the way you were mistreated last night on such and such a radio program. Do you want to file a complaint? Well, I said, I don't want folk talking about me like that. But at the same time, I can't lose sight of the fact that the forces of anti-democratic thinking in American culture are much more profound than these small groups that are going to call me out of my name. I think it's wrong for them to call me out of my name, but I can't allow that to obscure the larger forces at work. The problem, of course, becomes the way in which this intolerance is rearticulated, is reassigned virtue within black groups that want to, in one sense, police the ability of its members to think. This is not simple, so-called mere political correctness. I'm talking about something much more profound than that. I'm talking about the way in which people of color, as well as other Americans, but if we're talking about people of color, have to come to a point where we're able to see and say that we have interests beyond the mere reach of race. That we may have more in common as people of color with people like, say, for instance, Barbara Ehrenreich or Stanley Aronowitz or Henry Giroux or Brett Gary, than we have in common with Clarence Thomas. That's my vote. That's a personal autobiographical statement. That the mere rubric of race does not capture the complexity of our own conditions as people of color in this post-industrial later part of the 20th century American capital reality. And that means then that we've got to then look beyond the kind of narrow intolerances that rule and regulate the discourse of black organizations. And that means also we've got to deal with the dilemma of class realities on the one hand and inequalities, as well as the persistence of race and its meanings on the other hand. Malcolm saw this necessity near the end of his life. And to move to that ground is to move to a space where we're able to imagine a radically different future, where not only the appropriation by Malcolm's rhetoric in popular culture is recycled in pop culture forms like hip-hop culture or in black cinematic quests for authentic African-American identity, whether Spike Lee or John Singleton, that the agenda will be broadened, that we will begin to come to grips with these powerful internal contradictory forces that refuse to recede when race rhetoric is applied. Now, the importance of that is to understand the way in which popular culture, however, is a front for both resisting and capitulating to the very thing I'm talking about. That is to suggest, when I talk about rap music, a lot of people say, oh my God, you know, Malcolm would have been just outdone by rap music. Can you imagine a conversation between, you know, Malcolm X and Snoop Doggy Dogg? You know, Malcolm would say, you know, you've been bamboozled. You've been hoodwinked. You've been tricked. You've been outdone. But it's more complex than that, because hip-hop culture can be used to really call Malcolm on the very class inequities that he talked about. Because part of Malcolm's pathologization of the urban space was buying implicitly into the very white worldview he had denied. The contradiction that hip-hop culture can be used to point out to the black moral puritanism that Malcolm X promoted, that was class-based at a certain level. I'm not trying to suggest that puritanism is really the preserve of the middle class. I know too much about working-class people and so-called ghetto poor people in American culture who have some of the most powerful ethics and morality that we can see despite the new gingerization of American political discourse. That these folk are hard-working. I mean, Newt is talking about the virtues that black folk have been talking about for like 200 years. That many Americans have been talking about for two. This ain't nothing new. Talking about helping your neighbor and reaching out and that ain't nothing new, right? Now, when we talk about, now, compassion is called neo-compassion and kind of scandalously talked about within the grammar of American political discourse, neo-compassionism, right? Everybody's, every you know, boat on its own bottom and tub on its own bottom. And people have to take, you know, pull yourself up by your bootstraps and be responsible. Well, that's Booker T. Washington. Newt Gingrich ain't nothing but a kind of postmodern, chubby-cheeked, white-faced, pale-faced Booker T. Washington. Right? That ain't nothing new, right? I mean, Booker T. was coming with more flavor and color before he went out in 1915. Lisa said, put your pails down where you are. Newt don't want us to have a pail in our hand. If you ain't got a pail, it's your problem.
You're listening to Michael Eric Dyson on Malcolm X, The Politics of Race. This is Independent Alternative Radio. For copies of this program, call us 1-800-444-1977 or online our website, alternativeradio.org.
Virtue is nothing new to people of color. Ethics and morality and their relation is nothing new to African-American culture. The discourse of blame assigned to those poor people, however, is a vicious assertion of an age-old demonization of black poor people, especially black women. The painting of black women as welfare queens jives easily, ironically, with the hip-hop culture demonization of black women as bitches and hoes, which jives easily with the Nation of Islam's desexualization through the covenant of respect of black women's bodies. That's three powerful forces converging there. Not to mention Rousseau's conception of the culture of respect in the way in which it contains within the hierarchy of male gazes, women's bodies. Dang, that's four things coming together. Give me time, I could think about more. The powerful convergence of these forces and factors then, ironically, puts Malcolm X, Newt Gingrich, and Snoop Doggy Dogg at the same point. That's a dangerous reality that doesn't get talked about very often. Because whether you call a woman a welfare queen on the one hand, whether you pathologize them as the carriers of the most sick, of the worst kind of devil, Malcolm X early rhetoric, reality that we can imagine, or whether you're calling them bitches and hoes, it's the same difference. The reality is that in all three streams are converging at the point of the black female body. And so what we have to contest in Malcolm X are the way in which his own class consciousness is somehow obscured by his willingness to demonize uncritically the black ghetto poor. And the reason I talk about the black ghetto poor, because they get short shrift within the politics of American culture. They are the image boys and girls for all that's wrong in American society. All of us know that most people on welfare are not black. All of us know that most folk on welfare are not black women. All of us know that only 15% of people stay on welfare longer than 2 years and then come back later on. They employ it as an interim strategy until they can make ends meet. I lived on welfare for a while. We know that welfare can help those who need help. We know some people are getting over, but most of those are administrators who are pimping the system, driving Cadillacs and Rolls Royces home at night. They already faring well, but they pimping welfare. We know that, right? We understand that, but we don't see that presented in American political discourse. And even Bill Clinton has fallen prey to this narrow conception of the ability of the public sector and the private sector to join hands in the face of the government's refusal to deal with substantive structural realities connected to welfare. And so Malcolm X, ironically, is a point man for a very conservative black cultural agenda that refuses to have a class analysis precisely at the point when it's needed. Now, what also needs to be done with Malcolm's humane and radical legacy is to force us then into the obvious sphere of gender politics. And what we see with so many operations in African-American culture is the refusal to come to grips with gender. And the way in which gender continues to operate. And black feminist discourse is continually marginalized within the context of black male discourse about the problems of American society. Even the NAACP's problems of leadership cannot be dealt with for what they are. The crisis of imagination, not only of liberal political leadership that refuses to concede the complexity of African-American leadership in post-civil rights era, but it's a refusal to acknowledge the necessity for black feminist thought to take a central role in reconceiving black leadership for the next century. And the problem, of course, is that if even mainline and mainstream civil rights organizations refuse to concede that, even the so-called more extreme radical progressive organizations, in scare quotes, also refuse to concede that necessity. So that even as black women whose very bodies are being talked about and argued over, even as poor black welfare mothers whose very images are being degraded within the larger scope of American society and the American media, even black girls and boys who as children continue to receive the disproportionate brunt of poverty in American culture and get disproportionately undereducated, receive less health care, even as these populations are somehow mauled and mangled with an American public rhetoric about the problems of American society, black political leadership fails to confront the problems of gender. Now, it would be a lie to suggest that Malcolm X, during most of his life, provided us a role model to deal with these issues. The closest thing to a woman is a devil, he said during his early rhetoric. He grew to change his mind. And Malcolm's changing of his mind provides us a powerful way of rethinking feminist understandings of African-American problems. A feminist understanding of African-American problems refuses to divide or divorce conceiving black destiny from conceiving how women are somehow used by both white men and black men as ploys in their own agenda for self-realization and progress. Now, we see this across the board. We see this in mainstream civil rights organizations that though they have a disproportionate amount of women in as members, cannot seize leadership in that organization. We see this in African American ecclesiastical organizations, churches, and religious societies, where black women compose a disproportionate amount of the people who constitute that membership. And yet, they cannot seize leadership of those organizations. And we have to suggest that most of our leadership is not giving us the analytical tools or the intellectual resources, as is true with the larger American culture. And so what it means then is the necessity to, as Malcolm did, change our minds. George Clinton said, free your mind and your assets will follow. And so in one sense, and it can work both ways, right? We can be a materialist here. You can change, move your assets and your mind might get changed, right? It's a mutual kind of dialectical process. The point is here is that the changing of the minds of African-American people at the moment we appropriate Malcolm X means we have to allow Malcolm's challenge of transformative engagement with progressive forms of thought to hit at home with us. Now, obviously what that means as well is that Malcolm X, as an icon of transformation, forces us to re-examine the very principles upon which we base our own activity. And that means then we begin to be open to a wide variety of influences beyond gender and class to things like sexual preference. Of course, Malcolm might have fallen out of his chair, the young Malcolm, the Malcolm who died at 39, might not have ever imagined a world in which he could agree with gays and lesbians, because Malcolm directed the fierce rhetoric of homophobia against, as did his civil rights compatriots, against those gays and lesbians who were active in African-American freedom struggles. The interesting thing, of course, is that, as Bruce Perry points out in his book, Malcolm may have engaged in same-sex relationships as a young hustler, both as a young child and as a late teenager, engaging in hustling activity in Boston. The reality of that, of course, is that what does that suggest about the quintessential expression of machismo within the context of American black politics, especially in popular culture? It's a suggestive kind of breakage there. It's a suggestive kind of loop that we must then integrate into our own rethinking of progressive forms of thought that force us to rethink our own premises. And if Malcolm's own hustling activity, of course he would dismiss that. That's when I was a hustler, before I got saved, before I was converted. I linked that to the kind of hustling life of what I did before. That's all granted, it's all good. But with the suggestive possibilities inherent in Malcolm's own same sexual activity suggests to us that there are ways in which transgressive desires expressed by sexual difference within African-American communities can find a resonant voice within the context of American black politics. Now that takes a lot of rethinking, because when I go to many African-American gatherings, as well as of course with my mainstream colleagues, that goes over like a brick cloud. In Colorado here, well, the reality then is that as we deal and confront the necessity for transformative engagement with forms of thinking that force us to question ourselves, one of the ways in which we must do that is to ask questions of sexual difference as primary means of realizing the democracy that people like Malcolm X argued for. And that's the real point, that's the bottom line, is that democracy in the abstract is one thing. Democracy on paper is one thing. Democracy in principle is one thing. But democracy in practice is an ugly affair. It's a ramshackle, it's affair. It's a kind of Emersonian, self-rebegetting, improvisational, John Coltrane, Miles Davis kind of thing. And that means you got to integrate jazz chords of transformation in the context of your own reflections upon American society. And that forces people of color to take our cultural sensibilities and interject them into our political realities. And that improvisational ethic is a powerful, or that ethic of sampling, we could take hip-hop culture, is to use that powerful way of being open to sexual difference, as well as the very thing Malcolm had a great deal of problem with that I've already talked about. I'll be even more clear. That is black everyday culture, black popular culture, where Malcolm demonized the Lindy Hop. And he demonized the cunt. and he demonized the zoot suit, and he demonized the preoccupation with forms of pleasure that were either bodily or in regard to drugs. This black moral puritanism refused to concede that black popular culture could become a very vehicle for the expression of insurgent possibilities against the forces of white racism, if by no other means than allowing people to exist one more day. Now, of course, radical political examinations of such a belief says that that's a kind of stasis achieved by, you know, the opiate of the masses and the way in which we narcotize people, and in terms of a Gramscian hegemony, we secure their own complicity and their own oppression. Yeah, that's true. That's true on one hand, but I can't go all the way. I mean, Malcolm was a good Adornian in one sense. He had real suspicions about the possibility of popular culture to embody resistance against forms of oppression, but I think that the evidence of African-American culture means that popular culture embodies ways that people both are complicit in their own oppression, but also resistive to their own oppression. It's a both and, not an either or. And so the reality is that black popular culture embodies at certain points the ability to transform and reimagine a different future. So that there are moments of African-American hip-hop culture that connect to Malcolm's own powerful political preoccupations. Right? When we listen to Nas say, life's a bitch and then you die. That's why we get high, because you never know when we're gonna go. Right? Now, he ain't gonna get with Biggie Smalls. I mean, Malcolm can't go that route. I love it when you call me Big Papa. No, he's not gonna go that route, right? He's not going that route. But there are some significant moments within hip-hop discourse that allow the merging and fusion of radical political ideals articulated by the latter-day Malcolm, who is preoccupied with class warfare, and hip-hop culture, which is focused on the need for black people to wake up to the class differentiation in our own lives. My friends, is the Malcolm then who was able to be broad and universal without losing the particular appeal to young people of all generations and young people of all ages, and continually appeals to them precisely because there's something perpetually youthful about a figure who is martyred before 40 years old. The advantage, of course, of a person like Malcolm X and Martin Luther King Jr. over, say, Jesse Jackson or Farrakhan or even Nelson Mandela is that they were frozen in the pristine purity of martyrdom that scarcely swept away from their own lives the sweet scent of their achievement. And yet when you got to get up every morning and have a job at 55 and 60, 65 and 70, and to constantly forge ahead during the mundane, during the times of ennui and boredom, during times when people's radical political sensibilities cannot be piqued or sustained, that's the time when popular culture becomes a means by which people both engage in reflection on their culture and the way in which political engagement can find an compliant ally. And so this Malcolm appeals to us, but we've got to remake him. And the title of my book suggests, of course, is that the future of Malcolm's past is constantly being negotiated. His past is constantly being remade and reshaped and reformed. And what I say is that let's take advantage of that. The plasticity, postmodern malleability, the reformation of Malcolm X, not according to whatever narrow script we have that doesn't accord with historical investigation, not simply we're trying to pimp and prostitute his symbol without dealing with the substance of his challenge, but the ability to then take a figure who was radically improvising and remaking himself and use that as a metaphor for how we reconceive the possibility of talking to one another. Because the reality is in American culture is that we're losing a language of common citizenship that allows us to speak to one another. Now, how can we speak to one another most today? Did you see Brother Shipp? Did you see what happened on 90210? Did you see what happened, right? Television provides the unifying fictions of American citizenship, replacing the Constitution, the Declaration of Independence in a very real, visceral sense. Now, that's both tragic and titillating at the same time. Intriguing and really entrancing, and at the same time, quite problematic. But we find this common language that is not undercut by multiculturalism, that is not undercut by feminism, that is not undercut by gender specificity, or not undercut by gay and lesbian identity, that is not undercut by Asian American or Chicano or Latino identity, because diversity, after all, means that all of these streams have to participate. And the beauty of a Malcolm's dream near the end, the beauty of the metaphor of improvisation, of remaking and reforming, is that it puts forth a serious ethical obligation for all of us not to be dispassionate or on the sidelines, but to get involved, to somehow seize the opportunity to reshape and remake not only the icons that regulate our visions of what is possible, but to remake our own lives in conversation with one another. That, Malcolm X, is the most powerful force that can be unleashed through his historical remembrance, that then calls us and really invites us to participate in America, a changed, a transformed, a renewed America, without the narrow bigotries that continue to trump us even as we articulate the ideal of transracial, transsexual, and transnational cooperation. That, Malcolm, I submit, is the figure who looms large as the possible source of moral revisioning for a common language of both resistance and cooperation in American society. Thank you very kindly. But to answer your first question, in terms of can Malcolm X's image be reformed, I think it's up for grabs. And I think that what we have to do is make powerful claims intellectually upon that image, and moral claims, or intellectual claims upon his moral energies. You know, to see the way in which his own moral energies furnishes us the basis for rethinking intellectually some of the principles and ideas that he cherished most dearly. So yes, I think that it is possible, because his image has already undergone change. Right? I mean, when he died, folk were like dissing him. He's Malcolm, you know, evil kind of guy. Now black folk and white folk. I ain't just talking about white folk. I'm talking about black folk especially who like diss Malcolm. Now, you know, they like knew him and hung out with him and ran the street with him and went to the rallies with him. I was there when Malcolm, you know, delivered that ballot of bullet speech. Saw the bullet go by and the ballot get turned down, you know, and then all of a sudden they're recreating like they was homeboys with Malcolm. When Malcolm was alive, he was a dangerous Negro. Malcolm was there with that rhetoric. Folk were afraid. And they were afraid when Malcolm, you know, did this thing. And now, of course, through both a process of historical amnesia, as well as a kind of refusal to take seriously some of his ideals in concert with, I think, a real, actual, you know, kind of expanding of our understanding about what Malcolm was up to. So I think we've grown distant from Malcolm's immediate rhetorical fierceness and ferocity, which has allowed us to see that some of the stuff he was talking about was just plain out real. And so the containment of the forces of rage he unleashed, ironically through the apolitical posture of the Nation of Islam, is what we have to overcome. So yes, we can move beyond and reshape and reform his image precisely because we can get politically engaged in ways that Malcolm was prohibited for most of his life.
You were just listening to Michael Eric Dyson on Malcolm X, The Politics of Race. He spoke at the University of Colorado as part of Black History Month in 1995. This special program marks Malcolm X's centenary. Michael Eric Dyson, a globally renowned scholar of race, religion, and contemporary culture, is the Centennial Chair and University Distinguished Professor of African American and Diaspora Studies at Vanderbilt University. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, based in Boulder, Colorado. We're an independent nonprofit in our 39th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such voices as Claudia de la Cruz, Vijay Prashad, Robin D.G. Kelly, Winona LaDuke, Tariq Ali, Arundhati Roy, and Chris Hedges. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. For copies of today's program, Michael Eric Dyson on Malcolm X, The Politics of Race, call us 1-800-444-1977. Again, 1-800-444-1977. Or you can go on our website, alternativeradio.org. MP3s, PDFs, and printed transcripts are free of charge. To get them, just call us 1-800-444-1977. Series theme music is performed by the Kronos Quartet from Pieces of Africa. Joe Rich is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamyan. Thank you for listening. We go out with excerpts from Malcolm X's 1964 Ballot or the Bullet speech.
Whether you are a Christian or a Muslim or a nationalist, we all have the same problem. They don't hang you because you're a Baptist, they hang you because you're black. They don't attack me because I'm a Muslim, they attack me because I'm black. They attack all of us for the same reason. All of us catch hell from the same enemy. We're all in the same bag, in the same boat. We suffer political oppression, economic exploitation, and social degradation. All of them from the same enemy. The government has failed us. You can't deny that. Anytime you live in the 20th century, 1964, and you walking around here singing, "We shall overcome," the government has failed. This is part of what's wrong with you. You do too much singing. Today, it's time to stop singing and start swinging. You can't sing up on freedom, but you can swing up on some freedom. Cassius Clay can sing, but singing didn't help him to become the heavyweight champion of the world. Swinging helped him. But this government has failed us. The government itself has failed us. And the white liberals who have been posing as our friends have failed us. And once we see that all these other sources to which we've turned have failed, we stop turning to them and turn to ourselves. We need a self-help program, a do-it-yourself philosophy, a do-it-right-now philosophy. It's already too late philosophy. This is what you and I need to get with. And the only way we're going to solve our problem is with a self-help program. Before we can get a self-help program started, we have to have a self-help philosophy.
So today our people are disillusioned. They've become disenchanted. They've become dissatisfied. And in their frustrations, they want action. You'll see this young black man, this new generation, asking for the ballot or the bullet. That old Uncle Tom action is outdated. The young generation don't want to hear anything about the odds are against us. What do we care about odds? And I'm here to tell you, in case you don't know it, that you got a new generation of black people in this country who don't care anything whatsoever about us. They don't want to hear you old Uncle Tom handkerchief heads talking about the odds. No. This is a new generation.
And when I speak, I don't speak as a Democrat or a Republican. I speak as a victim of America's so-called democracy. You and I have never seen democracy. All we've seen is hypocrisy. When we open our eyes today and look around America, we see America not through the eyes of someone who has enjoyed the fruits of Americanism. We see America through the eyes of someone who has been the victim of Americanism. We don't see any American dream. We've experienced only the American nightmare. We haven't benefited from America's democracy. We've only suffered from America's hypocrisy. And the generation that's coming up now can see it and are not afraid to say it. If you go to jail, so what? If you're black, you were born in jail. If you black, you were born in jail. In the North as well as the South. Stop talking about the South. As long as you're south of the Canadian border, you're south. This is why I say it's the ballot or the bullet. It's liberty or it's death. It's freedom for everybody or freedom for nobody. America today finds herself in a unique situation. Historically, revolutions are bloody. Oh, yes, they are. They have never had a bloodless revolution or a non-violent revolution. That don't happen even in Hollywood. You don't have a revolution in which you love your enemy. And you don't have a revolution in which you're begging the system of exploitation to integrate you into it. Revolutions overturn systems. Revolutions destroy systems.
I came here to speak about the rights of nature. The rights of the river were recognized in Aotearoa, the Klamath River. The rights of mountains have been recognized in the Ecuadorian constitutional law. And a few years ago, corporations tried to get into some of that territory. And the Ecuadorian Supreme Court ruled the rights of nature superseded the rights of corporations.
That's Winona LaDuke, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Winona LaDuke on Rights of Nature, an Indigenous View. Indigenous peoples often see themselves as an integral part of nature, not separate from it, and recognize the interconnectedness of all living beings and nature. Indigenous perspectives on the rights of nature emphasize a deep spiritual bond with the natural world, viewing it as a sacred entity and an essential part of their cultural and social fabric. Many indigenous cultures believe that nature has inherent rights and that humans have responsibilities to respect, protect, and maintain the health of the environment for the well-being of future generations. Indigenous communities are increasingly in the forefront of the rights of nature movement, working to incorporate their values and beliefs into legal frameworks and policies. Our guest today is Winona LaDuke, an elder Anishinaabe. She's a brilliant and articulate representative of Indigenous perspectives. At the age of 17, she spoke at the United Nations on behalf of Native Americans. She's a founding member of Women of All Red Nations, and for many years she was the director of the Land Recovery Project on the White Earth Reservation in Minnesota. She was the 1996 and 2000 vice presidential candidate of the Green Party. She's the author of many books, including To Be a Water Protector. She spoke at the University of Oregon in Eugene in March 2025. And now, Winona LaDuke.
Anin Nindoy Maganado Kaloma relatives, so nice to see you all out there. So again, thank you so much for inviting me here. It's heartwarming to see all of you and to think about that these are the times that we must really work together. And this is an opportunity to do that. And so I'm honored to be here to join with you in that. As I said, Anin in Dinaway Muganatuk, that means hello, my relatives. In Dunjaba Oma'aking, that means I come from this land. But Aking means the land to which, the very land to which the people belong. It's not like private property. Aking means the land to which the people belong. That's kind of a different way of thinking, huh? And then there's Indakingamin, that means the very land to which I belong. And I think that that is what we must all take into our hearts, that we belong to this land. We belong to these rivers. We belong to this place. And in that, there is this reciprocal relationship where we take care and we give love, and she takes care of us. So that is always what we must reaffirm, because we live in a world that does not reaffirm that relationship. And so it is upon us individually and collectively to reaffirm. So as I was speaking, thinking to speak tonight, I wanted to put my friend Ingrid Washington Watak up. This is the 25th anniversary of her assassination. She was assassinated in Colombia by the FARC 25 years ago, an indigenous leader from Menominee. And she was a good sister of mine. She was a co-chair of the Indigenous Women's Network for about a decade and did really amazing international work. She was courageous and bold and funny and just one of the most beautiful people that you would ever know. And I think about, you know, as I get older, because I have really more winters behind me than ahead of me. You know, I'm 65 years of age. And as I note that, and as I see my sister goes, or maybe another sister goes, and then I see some of my brothers come home. Did you see that Leonard Peltier came home? Right. Right, my whole life. I just take a moment and say, that was a great thing, you know. Joe, you were kind of a chump sometimes, but that was a good one, huh? Man, I didn't know that was going to happen in my life. You know, in my life and in all of our lives, we carry like a basket. That's how I think of it, a basket of our cool things that we cherish. You know, it's not our will. It's our cool work. It's our spirit, the things that we cherish, the things that we value. And I think about when someone passes, there is this basket. And the things that are in the basket should be distributed so we all carry on. You understand what I'm saying? And so I've been thinking about this a lot, you know, not only as I get older, but also as I think about what it is that we do to keep intergenerational...